coming just a moment to open God's word to us. He is here with his wife, Jody, wife of nearly 28 years. I believe we've got an anniversary coming up next month. All right, so that's excellent. They also have two daughters, Bethany Christina, who was married this summer, age 23, and Rachel Elizabeth, age 19. She's at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. So it's just been a joy to spend time with them. This will be, I believe, Dr. Ware's sixth session with us. So never let it be said that we at Grace don't get the most out of our resources. Dr. Ware is the Senior Associate Dean of the School of Theology, Professor of Christian Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. And also, I might mention that some people have to pay to hear Dr. Ware speak that many times. Our own Ray, who is working through seminary classes, you guys get all of this for free. So he's come to share and pour out his God-given knowledge for you. Now, we have previously benefited from Dr. Ware's God-given wisdom through his books. As men, we studied the book, The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, expounding on the relationships that are found within the Trinity, and was the foundation of much of what Dr. Ware mentioned at the marriage conference already. But probably most importantly for us this morning, Dr. Ware has proven to be a man who takes his theology seriously and applies it to his life personally. A deep study of God should produce a great passion for God, and in Dr. Ware, this has been powerfully demonstrated. So it's my hope and prayer that as he passionately communicates with you this morning, that you would take that knowledge of God through the power of the Spirit and that you would be passionate and apply it as well. Please welcome Dr. Ware.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Sure. Thank you, Chris, and thank you to all of you again for the great privilege Jody and I have had to be down here with you. Ken and Gail Taggart lined this up and did most of the communication with us ahead of time and arranged for us to stay in this beautiful cabin, let's call it a mountain mansion that we're staying in up at top of the world. It's just astonishingly beautiful and pleasant to be there. We're very grateful for that. And thank you so much for the friendship. We support Bill and Kelly Housley. Kelly is their daughter. Bill and Kelly went out from Clifton Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, where I'm an elder there. And so we love the Housley family. We're so grateful for their ministry. And so we have very close ties through them to Ken and Gail and through them to your church. So we're very grateful for the wonderful work the Lord is doing here at Grace Community Church. And we'll pray that this continues and prospers in years to come. God is doing a good thing here, very good thing here at Grace Community. And so we just rejoice with you in that and pray for many good years to come for you. Well, this morning it is my distinct privilege to be able to bring you a portrait of who God is that I trust will be for you as it has been for me over a number of years now, a portrait that will help us understand with greater depth and richness who God is in his fullness. Hopefully that will mean more to you in just a moment, who God is in his fullness and what that means to us, his people. I am wondering if you all have handouts for this morning's message, do you? At the top it should read, "Beholding the God of Self-Sufficient Fullness." And just so you know, going into this, I know that I will not have time to go through all of the application points that I would love to share with you. And so, in light of that reality, anticipated reality, I printed them all out for you. So you'll find two full pages, as it were, of application of this. That if we don't go through all that, which I suspect we won't, you'll have it in print. And I would encourage you to read through that on your own, if you would. And just one more comment. If you want to expand on what we're thinking about this morning, the book that I have written that is available entitled God's Greater Glory, it's the one with the maroon cover, not to be confused with God's Lesser Glory, which is my critique of open theism, but God's Greater Glory is really what I'm talking about this morning with you in an expanded form. And so you're welcome to pick that up. And if the Lord uses that in your life, it would be very gratifying, of course, and what a great and a glorious God. What we're going to focus on this morning is an attribute of God which is seldom discussed in evangelical churches, And yet it is one of the, perhaps really in some significant ways, the most foundational understanding of who God is wrapped up in this notion that God is self-sufficient. And basically what I want to do with you this morning is define the term for you, first of all. Think about that definition with you. Take a look at some passages, beginning at Isaiah 40, and look there in a few other passages. Think for a moment about how that view of God is denied in our culture in which we live, and then apply the doctrine of God's self-sufficiency to our lives. So, definition, texts, denials, and application. That's essentially what we're looking at this morning. First of all, let me just introduce this by saying it is so clear that we live in a culture that is, as it were, enmeshed in a longing for self-esteem. We're being told by all kinds of gurus of our culture that if we're going to raise whole and healthy children, we need to build into them a healthy self-esteem concept. And I challenge this notion. I challenge you to consider whether from the Bible we ever, anywhere, at all, receive an encouragement from God to think in terms of self-esteem. It seems to me rather that the Bible from the first page, indeed the first verse of the first page, all the way through, is much about God-esteem and has nothing to say about self-esteem. In fact, here's one of the ironies. It's an irony very much like when Jesus said, if you wish to save your life, lose it. You lose it for my sake and you will find it. It's an irony along those lines that if we truly want persons to have a sense of significance and a sense of fulfillment in their lives, it does not come through self-esteem, but instead it comes precisely through esteeming God, who alone possesses everything that we lack, in drawing from Him the resources that are in Him and not in us. Precisely, they are in Him and we draw them into our lives. We are fulfilled and satisfied in great and glorious ways, not through self-esteem, but in fact through God-esteem. Should God be esteemed? Indeed, He should be. And is this good for us? Indeed, it is. Well, let's think about this together. Self-sufficiency of God. You can see on your handout, I give you a definition there of this doctrine. To say that God is self-sufficient is to say that God possesses within Himself, intrinsically and eternally, every quality in infinite measure. God possesses within Himself, intrinsically and eternally, every quality in infinite measure. Now, what do I mean by He possesses qualities? Well, what I mean there is that God possesses within Himself everything that is qualitatively good. Anything that you can think of and everything that is qualitatively good is possessed in God. There is no quality that exists apart from God. If it is a quality, if it is qualitatively good, it is God's. The Puritans used to call these qualities perfections. That is, every perfection, everything we can think of that is a perfection. For example, love and holiness and goodness and justice and wisdom and knowledge and power, these are all qualities. Anything that we can think of that is qualitatively good, a perfection, is possessed within God. Now, He possesses these qualities. Look at the definition. He possesses them within Himself intrinsically. Now, some of you might wonder, is that a redundancy? Do you have to say that He possesses these qualities within Himself intrinsically? And the answer is, it's not a redundancy, because, precisely because, it's possible to possess something within yourself that is not intrinsic to you. You take it in from outside. It is an extrinsic reality that you take within yourself. It comes to reside within you, but it is not intrinsic to you. So, for example, the best example I can think of that's easy to imagine is, take a deep breath of air right now. All of you ready? Feels good, doesn't it? Yeah, all right. Well, that air that fills your lungs is within you, but it is not intrinsic to you. It's extrinsic to you, and that's precisely why you took it in, because you need to take it in from outside. This is the point with God. There are no qualities that can be given to God from outside that come to dwell within Him. They are all His by virtue of His being God. They are His by nature. He doesn't receive any of these things from outside. He's not beholden to anybody for anything, because He possesses within Himself everything that is qualitatively good within His own being intrinsically. And He possesses these qualities within Himself eternally. Wow, there never has been a time, is not now, nor will there ever be a time when these qualities are not God's qualities possessed by Him within His own nature. And then at the end of the definition, He possesses these qualities in infinite measure. Infinite is a negative term, not finite. So what does finite mean? Synonym for finite? Well, restricted, bounded, limited, measured. God possesses all of these qualities in infinite measure, without restriction, without boundary, without limitation. Wow, limitless power, limitless goodness, limitless holiness, justice, knowledge, wisdom, possessed within the very nature of God, intrinsically and eternally and infinitely. Wow, what an amazing God God is. Well, is this taught in the Bible? Indeed it is. Turn, if you would, to Isaiah 40 for our first glimpse of this. Isaiah 40. And we'll look there at verses 12 to 17 primarily. Isaiah 40, verse 12. Now, at the beginning of verse 12, God, through Isaiah the prophet, begins asking a series of rhetorical questions. You know what rhetorical questions are, don't you? They are questions whose answer is so obvious you don't need to give an answer. Is the Pope Catholic? I don't think we need to answer that question. We know the answer. So here are rhetorical questions that God gives us through the prophet about Himself. Verse 12, who do you know, asks the Lord, who has measured the waters in the hollow of His hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Now think of the images that are here. You know, don't race past these images in the Bible. They are rich and they are there for a reason. Who do you know, asks the Lord, who has measured the waters of this world? The Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, which would be familiar to our prophet Isaiah. Who do you know who has measured these waters in the hollow of His hand? You know anybody big enough to do that? Wow, what an image. I remember with great relish an incident with my own two girls. Jody and I and our two daughters were on vacation at one of the most beautiful places in all of creation, and that's Cannon Beach, Oregon. Absolutely gorgeous. And we had a little cabin that was right on the beach. And after breakfast that morning, we had had devotions, and I had read from Isaiah 40 to our family. And we read this passage, and after breakfast, I said to the two girls, I said, hey, Bethany and Rachel, do you want to do an experiment with me down at the beach? Oh, yeah, Daddy. So, you know, they're excited. They're about 7 and 4 years old. So they grabbed their towels, and we head on down there. And I said, now, do you remember that passage we read this morning about how God can measure the waters in the hollow of His hand? Yeah, remember that? Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. I am going to go out here into the Pacific Ocean, just a little bit, wait out here a bit. You stay here on the shoreline, and I want you to look out there at the level of the ocean, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to stoop down and scoop up in my two hands all of the Pacific Ocean I can hold, and I want you to watch carefully and see how far the level of the ocean dips. Okay, Daddy. So they're ready to do this. They're excited. So I go out there. I'm waiting out there about knee high, and they're looking. And I say, okay, now, girls, are you ready? Now watch carefully. I'm going to scoop up the water. Okay, so here we go. And I scoop it up. Did it change? No, Daddy. I said, oh, come on. Let's try it again. So now watch carefully. Watch carefully. So I scoop down, scoop it up. Did it change? No, Daddy. So I came back and got down on my knees, eye level with my girls, and looked at them, and I said, now, girls, I want you to learn something that's a very important lesson about the difference between how big God is and how big we are. See, I'm your dad. I'm a big guy. You know, they were 7 and 4, you know. I'm a big guy. And I go out there into the water, and I scoop up all the water that I can in the hollow of my two hands, and you can't tell anything has changed. I said, now look at this ocean. Imagine a hand so big that if it came down and scooped up the water, that ocean bed would be dry. That's how big God is. Wow, what an amazing picture. Look at the next image in verse 12. Who do you know, asked the prophet, who has marked off the heavens by the span, the distance between the tip of your thumb and little finger. It's a measuring instrument you have with you all the time. Who do you know who has marked off the heavens by the span, the heavens? I mean, this image, of course, would have been very meaningful in Isaiah's day. How much more meaningful can it be for us when we know something about the extent and the immensity of the heavens? I mean, think with me just for a moment. You all know this, but just think. Light travels at what speed? 186,000 miles per second. 186,000 miles per second. The light from the sun, from the time it leaves the sun until it arrives at planet Earth, traveling at that speed takes about 7.5 minutes to get here, to travel that 93 million miles from sun to Earth, 7.5 minutes. Now, the next closest star to us after the sun is 4.5 light years away. That is light, when it leaves that star, traveling at 186,000 miles per second, takes 4.5 years before that light reaches planet Earth. That star is our next door neighbor. It's our next door neighbor. When you go out on a starlit night, you know, and look up at the canopy of stars out there in the heavens, do you know that almost every speck of light you see out there is a star in our neighborhood called the Milky Way galaxy? They're just stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There's how many stars are there in the Milky Way galaxy? Roughly 10 billion. 10 billion stars separated by an average distance of 10 light years from each other spread across the Milky Way galaxy form our neighborhood in the universe. How many galaxies are there in the universe? And the answer is hundreds of millions of galaxies, and the Milky Way galaxy is an average-sized galaxy. Hundreds of millions of galaxies spread out thousands and millions of light years from each other, sprawling across this universe. Who do you know who has marked off the heavens by the span? Wow, what an image of the immensity and the greatness and the power of God. Who do you know, verse 12, who has calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Who do you know who can hold the scales that weigh the mountains, weigh the Rockies over here? Let's add the Smokies to it. The Smokies. Put on here, on the other side, the Himalayas. Who do you know who can hold the scales that weigh the mountains? Wow, the power, the immensity, the greatness, the awesomeness of God. Okay, now verse 13, the subject shifts from the immensity and power of God now to his knowledge and wisdom. Verses 13 and 14, the rhetorical questions continue. Who do you know, asked the Lord, who has ever directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has informed him, with whom did he consult and who gave him understanding? Who taught him the path of justice? And who taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? What are the answers to these rhetorical questions? Who has ever counseled God? Answer? No one. Absolutely no one. God has no advisors. He needs no advisors. In fact, God wants no advisors. Why? Because he knows everything, and his discernment and his wisdom, his use of that knowledge, is perfect. We cannot contribute to the understanding, the knowledge, and the wisdom that is God's. Now, I just contrast this. Imagine we have an election in, what is that going to be? Not this one, but 2008 presidential election. Imagine we elect a new president in 2008. Right after taking the oath of office, the first thing he declares is this: I will have no cabinet. I will have no advisors. I know everything that is necessary for me to know as president of the United States. I don't want anybody's advice or help. What do you think would happen? How about impeachment hearings that begin immediately upon seconds after he took the oath of office? I mean, we would think and think rightly, what a fool this man is who thinks he knows everything and doesn't need anybody's advice. But this is the difference between us and God, who doesn't ever learn anything from us. He cannot learn anything from us because he already knows everything, and his wisdom is flawless in discerning what is best to do on the basis of what he infinitely knows. Amazing. You know, I think sometimes in our praying, we cross the line from bringing our requests before God as humble children of his. We cross the line into becoming advisors of the Almighty. And honestly, friends, we ought never cross that line. It is one thing to recognize we have deep desires and longings, and God wants us to bring those, as parents long for their children, to come and speak with them about their deepest needs and desires. But then to recognize he is God, and we are not. So not my will, but yours be done. Goodness, if Jesus prayed that, how much more should we? Pray this and recognize God alone knows what is best. Okay, now, back to our text. After looking in verse 12 at the immensity and the power of God, verses 13 and 14, the knowledge and the wisdom of God, what are the implications for us? Well, my friends, are you ready to see what we're going to see here? You know, I think sometimes we ought to put a little warning in the Bible at certain points. This one ought to read, warning, your pride is about to be assaulted. Indeed, it is. Look at what we see. Verse 15, in light of the greatness of God, what do we read? Behold, the nations. Now get the point right there before we read any more. The nations, that is, the collective totality of humanity taken together. All of our power and prowess and knowledge and wisdom collectively considered, the nations are like what? Are like a drop from a bucket. They're regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Now, what's common in those two images? Drop from a bucket, speck of dust on the scales. They both communicate what? They're insignificant. They're trivial. They are inconsequential. A speck of dust on the scales doesn't weigh in. Isn't that the point? I mean, imagine a woman at the deli counter, you know, down at your local grocery store, and she's getting some sliced turkey, and he's cut it off. It's a pound of turkey, and he's put it on the scale, and he's about to press the button for the price sticker to come out, and she screams, "Hold it! Wait a minute! There's a speck of dust on that scale. I don't want to be overcharged." I mean, we would laugh and go, "Come on, lady. I mean, a speck of dust won't make a difference." Isn't that the point? A drop from a bucket, a speck of dust on the scale, convey the nations and the totality that they are before God, inconsequential. inconsequential, insignificant, trivial. Now, lest we think, at least we're a drop, at least we're a speck of dust on the scales, keep reading, folks. It gets worse. It gets worse. Keep reading with me. Behold, the nations are a drop from a bucket. They're regarded as a speck of dust in the scales. Behold, he lifts up islands like fine dust. The image there is, it's like a little kid at the beach running sand through his fingers. That's what God does with the islands. I mean, he plays with them. They're playthings to God. Even Lebanon, that area to the north of Israel, is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations, verse 17, are like what now? All the nations are as nothing before him. Well, folks, we've been demoted. We've gone from drop from a bucket and speck of dust on the scales now to nothing. And you think, it can't get worse than that, can it? It does. Keep reading. Verse 17, all the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. Wow, we've hit bottom. Less than nothing and meaningless. Okay, now, it is crucial to see what this means and what it does not mean. It's crucial. When God says to the nations, you are less than nothing and meaningless, it is clear he does not mean by that, I don't care about you. You mean nothing to me. How do we know that's the case? How do we know that God does not mean that he doesn't care about the nations, that he considers them worth nothing to him? How do we know that? Well, you might say the cross of Christ. God so loved what? The nations, the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. I mean, that's one answer we can give to that. You know what? In Isaiah 40 itself, it just in this chapter, you know as you read it that the purpose that God has in making this clear to the people is precisely because they mean much to him. He wants their best. Look with me toward the end of the chapter. Pick up with me at verse 25. Verse 25, and we'll read to the end of the chapter. To whom then will you liken me, that I should be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number, and calls them all by name. Can you imagine? You remember how many stars we just talked about there are in the universe? Milky Way has 10 billion. Hundreds of millions of like-sized galaxies. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Why does God want his people to understand the greatness of his power, his wisdom? Why? Read on. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. The justice due me escapes the notice of my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary. To him who lacks power, to lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not be tired. They will walk and not become weary. Can you see it? Why does God want his people to know how strong, how wise, how great he is? Answer. So that when they experience their own weakness, they are tired and downcast, they will reach out and wait upon, trust in, hope in the God who never gets tired, who is infinite in his power, whose wisdom is unassailed. They will put their hope in God. That's why he wants his people to know how great he is. So when he says, back to verse 17, when he says, the nations are as nothing before me, they are regarded by me as less than nothing and meaningless, he does not mean, I don't care about those nations. They mean nothing to me. What does he mean? Are you ready? Ready to feel the weight of God's greatness and our littleness? Here's the answer. When you compare all that the nations are and have, and ask yourself the question, what can they, what can we contribute or add to the greatness of the power and the knowledge and the wisdom of God? What is the answer? Nothing, absolutely nothing can be added to the greatness of God. Why? Because He has it all. It puts God in His place, and it puts us in our place. Yes, indeed, God is self-sufficient. He possesses within Himself, intrinsically and eternally, every quality in infinite measure. What can we add to the fullness that is God's? Nothing, says the prophet. Compared to me, you are less than nothing and meaningless. Wow. Okay, let's look at another passage. Other passages that speak of the self-sufficiency of God. Very quickly, Psalm 50. Turn back, if you would, to Psalm 50. Israel is on trial in this psalm. And amazingly, God functions in three capacities in relation to Israel. Israel is on trial. God is the judge who will judge the case against Israel. God is also the prosecuting attorney who prosecutes the case against him. God is also chief witness, star witness against them. So he's all three. He's judge, attorney, prosecuting attorney, and witness. Pick up with me at verse 6. Verse 6, the heavens, he says, declare his righteousness, and God himself is judge. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. I will testify against you. I am God, your God. I do not reprove you for your sacrifices. Your burnt offerings are continually before me. Do you see that in verse 8? Now, stop there a second. This is kind of a surprise, because what that indicates, what verse 8 indicates, is that these are actually some of the good days in Israel. These are days when they were actually obeying the law and bringing sacrifices that they were told to bring. So you might think, what's the problem? They're doing what the law commands. They are sacrificing to the Lord. Well, keep reading. We'll see what the problem is. Verse 9, I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls and drink the blood of male goats? Stop. We now have the information we need to find out what the problem is. Israel had evidently adopted a theology of worship that was utilized and practiced in the nations that surrounded her. How did this work? The nations that surrounded Israel believed that the gods were needy. The gods got hungry. The gods got thirsty. And so when they would bring sacrifices to the gods, they would eat those sacrifices, have their bellies filled, drink the blood of those sacrifices, have their thirst quenched. When the gods had their needs met, then they in kindness would bestow kindness to the people who helped them out. So we help God out, and He helps us out. And Israel had adopted that understanding of Yahweh. So God says to His people, if I were hungry, don't miss the if there, if I were hungry, I would not tell you. The world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat? Do you really think when you bring these sacrifices, I am benefiting from what you're bringing? Do you think I eat the flesh of bulls and drink the blood of male goats? Here's the solution to the problem. verse 14 and 15. Look at it with me. So offer to God a sacrifice of what? Thanksgiving. Think. What does thanksgiving imply about the God-human relationship? If we thank God, who's the giver? Who's the provider? God is. Who are the needy people who get helped? We are. The dependency relationship between God and the world runs one way. The dependency relationship between God and the world runs one way. We depend upon God for everything, as we'll see in Acts 17 in the next passage we look at, for life and breath and all things. We depend upon God for everything. How much does He depend upon us for His life and His well-being and His prosperity? Nothing. Not at all. Look at verse 15. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will rescue you, and you will honor me. This is how it works. God is provider. We thank Him for His provision. God is protector. We thank Him and honor Him for His powerful rescuing of us. God is God. He is above any need. Need, says Tozer, in The Knowledge of the Holy, his chapter on the self-sufficiency, need is a creature word, not fitting for the Creator. It's a great statement from A.W. Tozer. Turn to Acts 17, the last passage we'll look at together. Acts chapter 17, Paul is in Athens, beginning at verse 16. And as he tours the city of Athens, he is very troubled in his spirit because he observes the idolatry that is all over the city. Shrines, inscriptions, altars that are all through Athens. And so he's provoked within his spirit. He begins to go out and proclaim the true God to these people. They are intrigued by this. They haven't heard about this. And so they invite Paul to come to the Areopagus, where he then tells them about the true God. So pick up with me at verse 22. Verse 22 of Acts 17. So Paul, at their invitation, stood in the midst of the Areopagus, and he said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this God I proclaim to you." So here it is, verses 24 and 25 lay out, I mean, this is really theology 101. This is what you must know about God to get Him right. Here it is. "The God who made the world and all things in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He served by human hands as though He needed anything." Do you see self-sufficiency there? "He is not served by human hands as though He needed anything, since He Himself gives to all life and breath and all things." Now, self-sufficiency is right there on the surface in the middle verses 24, 25. He is not served by human hands as though He needed anything. And now there are three arguments that support it. The first one is the beginning of verse 24, creation. God is creator, the God who made the world and all things in it. Now, think with me. How is it that God as creator supports the idea that He is self-sufficient? Think. What's the connection between God as creator and God being self-sufficient? Can you see it? Well, if God is creator, that means He exists as God before and apart from the created order. Therefore, God cannot, by definition, be dependent upon a creation that doesn't exist while He is God. You see it? God is God apart from this creation. Furthermore, the fact that God creates the world indicates that everything in the creation has come out from God. Therefore, nothing in the creation stands independently existing from God. It cannot exist apart from God, and it cannot provide anything to God that God lacks. Everything there is rather given to it by God. Second argument, in verse 24, Not only is he creator, but he is Lord or ruler. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth. He reigns over everything that he has made. So it's just like Psalm 50. If I were hungry, I would not tell you. For the world is mine and all it contains. To make it is to own it. To own it is to have rightful rulership over it. Well, how much did God make? The heavens and the earth, it's all his. He's not beholden to anything or anyone in any part of the created order to give to God something he lacks. Third, the final argument, he's creator, he's Lord. The final argument comes at the end of verse 25. He is giver, with a capital G. Giver of what? Since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Think particularly of the two uses of all in that passage. And it's the same in Greek. Two times do you see the word all in Greek in that text. He gives to all people all things. Well, I submit to you, if he gives all things to all people, then he must possess first all things to give all things. So it's all contained in God. Indeed, he lacks nothing. He possesses everything. He possesses within himself intrinsically and eternally every quality in infinite measure. How great is our God. Now, very, very briefly, there are two ways I want to mention in just a moment each that God's self-sufficiency is denied and undermined in our culture. One is from a movement in theology that you probably never heard of, and you may not hear of it again after today, but it is the most influential movement in theology in the 20th century in North America. It is called process theism, process theology. And in the process view, they hold the view that God, as with everything else, is in process. Everything is in flux, according to process theology. God himself is in process. God is becoming. They say that the notion of God as being is denied. God is becoming. Now, how is God becoming? How does God in process? How is he changing? Well, most importantly, he changes and gets better day by day, as we, this is an exact quote from Charles Hartshorne, a process theologian, as we contribute value to God, which he would otherwise lack. As we contribute value to God, which he would otherwise lack. So Hartshorne and process theologians believe that really the greatest religious aspiration is to try to serve the Lord, and by that they mean just exactly what Paul is denying in Acts 17. He is not served by human hands as though he needed anything. They believe God is served by us as we serve him and help him out, serve him and make him better, serve him and increase both the experience of joy in God and the qualities that are true within God. Process theism detests. They know the doctrine of self-sufficiency. I know it because I've read in their writings that they know about it, and they deny it and detest the doctrine of divine self-sufficiency. Now, here's a second way in which self-sufficiency is denied, and that is in popular evangelical theology. That is in our churches, in our churches. Here's how it goes. I can give you an autobiographical story here. I can remember as a fifth grade boy in the Baptist church I grew up in Spokane, Washington, sitting there in that basement room, picture it, fifth grade boys, spit wads, rubber bands, paper clips, you know, you can kind of picture, can't you? Fifth grade boys, and the teacher, a friend of mine asked the teacher the question, why are we here? Why did God make us? And here was her answer. I've heard it in different forms 100 times at least out there. Why are we here? Answer, God was lonely. He was all by himself. You know, he had no one to talk to, no one to have fellowship with, and he just felt, you know, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if there were some other people out there who could talk with me and have fellowship with me. And so this ache in God's own heart was filled as we came into existence and helped him out. And you know, that notion of God as poor God, lonely God, needy God, that idea of God really did figure into almost everything else I heard about God growing up in that church. Missions calls fit this perfectly. Missions calls. Oh, God wants so badly to get the message out there to people. He wants these people to be saved. But unless you go, God can't do it. He needs someone to go. Poor God. Now, of course, let me just pause here for a second. Of course, God does call missionaries to go. He has designed that the means by which people come to faith is through hearing the gospel of Christ. Romans 10, this is absolutely true. But be clear on this. God chose to do it that way when he could. Goodness, what could he do right now? He is omnipotent and omnipresent. What could he do? How about whisper the gospel in every person's ear in perfect dialect across this globe simultaneously? How about that for missions? Of course he could. He could write it in the sky. He could proclaim it from a heavenly bullhorn in everybody's language perfectly. Don't think for one minute because God designed to do it this way, it means God needs us to do it. He doesn't. So, in fact, this view of God that was out there in the culture that I grew up in is a denial of God's self-sufficiency. God possesses within himself every quality in infinite measure. What does that mean for us? Well, I'm just going to start you on this and rely that you take a look at these other two pages yourself. But look at this with me. Applications, implications and applications. First of all, capital letter A, because God is infinitely and eternally full, rich, joyous, satisfied. That is, because God is self-sufficient, look at these implications. Number one, God does not need the glorious creation he has made, either in whole or in part, including his creation of human beings. As humble as it is true, God does not need us. You know, honestly, if you have not learned this, my friends, this will hit you as a sour pill until you think and pray it through and you realize it is so true. God is God. The rich and infinitely full being that he is, he doesn't need us. We are not here to fill a void in God's poor life. You can read the other four points. I'm jumping now down to capital letter B, implications. This is the only one we'll do, and with this we'll stop. Capital letter B of Roman numeral 4, key questions that arise out of God's self-sufficiency. Why are we here? What is our purpose? The answer is not that God was lonely and needed fellowship. Psalm 50, he's offended and dishonored for us to think this way. So what is the answer? Here it is. I'll read it to you. You can read it along with me. Rather, particularly in relation to his people, the answer is this. Though he doesn't need us, be astonished. He loves us. And his purpose in creating and redeeming us is not that we might fill up some lack in him. There is no lack. But that he might fill us up with himself. He made us empty to be filled with his fullness. Thirsty to drink of the water of life. Weak to receive his strength. Foolish to be instructed and corrected by his wisdom. In his love, he longs to give, to share the bounty. He wants us to experience in finite measure the fullness of joy and blessing that he knows infinitely, all to redound to the praise and the glory of his name.